Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Joining me today in studio is columnist and novelist Leonard Pitts. He's in Charlotte to promote his latest work of historical fiction, and of course, he also happens to be one of the nation's most eloquent voices on the legacies of slavery, prejudice, and inequality in America. His new novel is The Last Thing You Surrender. Well, the novel itself isn't The Last Thing You Surrender. That's the book's title. See, words matter. The novel tells three interrelated stories. The first involves a privileged white Marine named George Simon. The second follows a young African-American widow named Thelma Gordy, who was a widow because her husband died saving George Simon during the Pearl Harbor attacks. And the third major plot line follows Thelma's brother, Luther Hayes, as he becomes part of a fighting tank battalion comprised of black soldiers. All three characters are from Mobile, Alabama. The Jim Crow South plays a major role in the story. From Alabama to Guadalcanal and beyond, The Last Thing You Surrender shows the horror and violence caused by human hatred and discrimination. Here, for example, is the perspective of Luther Hayes, the tank battalion soldier. When the battalion stumbles into a concentration camp late in the war, he can't comprehend the suffering he sees. Pitts describes Luther's reaction like this. He was a man who had seen his parents tortured and burned to death before his very eyes at his own front door by white people. It had never occurred to him that their capacity for bestial cruelty did not stop with the woes they inflicted upon Negroes. Leonard Pitts, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you for having me.
So you dedicated this book to your parents,
right,
including your father, mm-hmm, who was an Army corporal. How much did your father tell you about his military experience, and how did that influence this book?
Actually, my father tried to tell me about his military experience, but he died when I was 18, and at that age, I really wasn't interested in listening to anything the old folks had to say. Which I really regret at this point. If I had listened, I would have known a lot more. As it is, I have a bunch of old pictures of my dad in various places taken, you know, during the war and during his military service, but don't really know as much about him as I'd like to. The only reason I know he was a driver on the Red Ball Express, but the only reason I know that is because he told an older cousin of mine who had the good sense to listen, as opposed to me, who was, you know, more busy, more concerned with catching the latest episode of Speed Racer or something else, you know, of vital importance.
Well, and he obviously plays a cameo in your book,
right,
doing that job. That must have been fun to,
right,
sort of bring your father back to life.
It was sort of a wink to my dad and to my siblings whenever they when they read the book. You know, my cousins and whomever when they read the book, it was sort of a wink to them and a little homage to my father. You know, I gave my dad a lot of grief in one of my earlier books, Becoming Dad, talking about our relationship. So this is a way of sort of balancing the scales and saying, hey, Dad, you know, thanks for helping to save the world. By the way.
Yeah, that probably deserves a thank you.
Yeah.
The book, as I mentioned, starts with Pearl Harbor, where George Simon, one of your main characters, survives the attack after being saved by a black man who works in the ship's mess hall.
Right.
George is injured after the bombing, and he's also racked with guilt when his rescuer dies. So he goes home to Mobile, Alabama, and he learns that the man who saved him was also from Mobile, Alabama. Why did you choose that city as your setting?
Because I wanted to depict the riot. There was a riot in 1943 at the shipyard over on Pinto Island, the ADSCO, and I forget what the acronym stands for, Alabama Dry Dock Ship something. There was a riot there that was sort of emblematic to me of the way the nation came together but didn't during the war years. In 1941, after the Pearl Harbor attack, there was all this sense of Americans coming together to fight a common foe, and that lasted for a while, as it did after 9/11. But by 1943, you had race riots in Detroit, you had them in Harlem, and you had them at the shipyard in Mobile, and I think it was in 44, I may have the year wrong, there was a riot against Mexican Americans in Los Angeles. So I really wanted to depict the one in Mobile, specifically not just because it depicted a nation that was not as together as it should have been, but that it depicted a riot, a race riot, that actually disrupted production of ships, you know, materiel for the war at a time when materiel for the war was crucial. So it's like, you know, these people prioritize their racial woes, their racial angst or purity or anger, even above getting ships out, you know, to help the war effort. That, to me, said a lot.
And that's obviously a pivotal moment in the book. Is that when you learned about that historical event, is that what set you in the direction with this book?
It was one of many things. I was, for some reason, you go through phases, and for some reason I found myself drawn to the early 1940s. I was just fast. I found myself reading stuff and looking at movies and listening to music, and then you start to say, okay, I'm sort of doing some de facto research here. So that if I'm interested enough to be doing all of this, maybe there's a book in there somewhere. So I started thinking of it like that. The Ken Burns documentary, The War, really just fascinated me. I don't know how many times I've seen that thing, but just looking at that really fascinated me and sort of helped to set me on this path of wanting to explore that in historical fiction.
Again, my guest is Leonard Pitts, Jr. He's the author of the new novel, The Last Thing You Surrender. This early portion of the novel introduces a theme that you explore throughout, which is whether people can reconcile their long-held beliefs and suspicions. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind reading a passage where George is home in Mobile, Alabama. He is speaking to his fiance. She has used a racial epithet, which is, of course, not uncommon in the South during that time. And here are some of the thoughts that he has as that's happening.
Okay. And it was right in that moment that he suddenly knew what was wrong with him, what had been wrong with him ever since they hauled him up out of the carcass of that ship, and had only grown worse with each step closer to home. He knew what was wrong, and he suspected that subconsciously he had known all along. He was alive. That's what was wrong. He was alive. He was home. It was Christmas. He was with his family. And Eric Gordy was a waterlogged corpse that would never see burial. How, he wondered, did God decide such things? How did God say, "You shall live, you whose courage faltered in the moment of trust, you who were worthless and scared, shall miraculously survive through no virtue of your own. But you, who gave the other man the courage he lacked, who carried him on your back when he could not carry himself, will come to the very edge of survival and then be snatched from life by a meaningless, freakish accident." The man had slipped, and cracked his head, and drowned in water he could have escaped just by standing. Where was the fairness in that? Where was the righteousness? And where was God? The question flayed his heart. That God had to be somewhere in it, George Simon did not doubt, even for a second. His faith was strong, but his understanding failed him entirely. And his guilt chewed on him from the inside out, from the inside, ate through his vitals like some burrowing beast. George realized that he hated his own survival, hated the breaths that swelled his chest, hated the fact that he would enjoy sunrises and kisses, but Eric Gordy never would. Eric Gordy was dead forever. Eric Lamont Gordy, messman third class. And how fitting was it that until 6 days after the attack, George had not even known his full name. Indeed, the very morning of the attack, he'd had to guess at the fragment of name he did know. And yet, he and Gordy had served on the same ship. Worse, they were also from the same place. He had felt a sickness when Reeves told him that, had felt the bottom fall out of his gut. Eric Lamont Gordy had been just another invisible Negro in a world full of invisible Negroes, a world where they lived their lives and you lived yours, and you never even saw them unless you needed an ashtray to be emptied, a shoe to be signed, a refill of your coffee. They had walked the same street, he and Eric Lamont Gordy, had gazed up at the same sky, shopped in the same stores, been shaped by the same slow, genteel elegance that sometimes made Mobile feel as if it belonged to the last century, as if it had no place in the restless bustle of modern days. And yet, though they had come from the same place and served on the same ship, they were strangers, strangers even after Gordy rescued him, strangers right up until the instant of Gordy's death, strangers even now.
Thank you for reading that. It's Leonard Pitts Jr. From his new novel, The Last Thing You Surrender. And, of course, I'm not giving you any information you don't already know, which is that that's taking place in the 1940s, and yet it's really not much of a stretch to think that there are plenty of situations here and across the country where people are living in separate worlds.
Yeah, and are invisible. Some of us are invisible to others of us. I think of that theme a lot, even when I'm out at restaurants or whatever, and the servers are coming up, and or the people are bussing the tables and whatever. And it's like, do you really see these people? Mm-hmm. All these people that are in your life, that are making your life a little easier, a little more pleasant, are they really physically there for you?
I should mention that Mr. Pitts will be at Park Road Books tonight at 7 o'clock. I assume you'll be reading and signing.
I will be reading and signing and answering questions.
Yeah. When you were working on this book, how much consideration did you give to balancing the violence, the harsh language, all of which are necessary and realistic, with some sense of hope for the reader?
It's funny you should ask. A gentleman told me just yesterday, and he loved the book, but he was saying that he was so grateful that the end of the book had some hope to it, because I think after having vicariously lived through World War II, if there hadn't been some hope, I think he would have walked in front of a bus. So and we don't want that to happen. So yeah, it was definitely a balancing act, because the one thing that you don't want to do is to soft pedal what that generation went through, what they endured, in order to salve our sensibilities in this era. So I wanted to make sure that I fairly represented what it was like to be fighting at Guadalcanal, or what it was like to come upon a concentration camp, or what it was like to be in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, and yet at the same time to come out of it with some sense of hope. That's why the ending of the book, and I won't give too much away except to say that it's one of my favorite parts.
It's a good one.
Yeah, because it does kind of point towards something potentially better if we can just ever get our acts together.
And of course, as you're talking about what these people live through, one of the most interesting things and most important things, I think, in the book is that you make it very clear that while people, in a way, pulled together in very heroic ways, look, we're still talking about humans. We're still talking about all kinds of prejudice and suspicion and anger and resentment going on. Life continues.
Yeah. You know, life didn't stop for them on December 7th, 1941, any more than it stopped for us on September 11th, 2001. You know, you have these great moments. I remember a lady after the September 11 attacks sent me an email that said something to the effect of, hopefully those stupid prejudices are gone from us forever. And it was such a lovely thought, but I knew, just because I understand history, that no such thing would happen. We tend to want our salvation to arrive like a lightning bolt. Suddenly, okay, we understand it. Yes. We get it. You
got
know,
it. Yeah.
Kumbaya. We shall overcome. Let's all be one. And it doesn't arrive. It'll never arrive like a lightning bolt. It's work and it's commitment.
Yeah, like I believe we were heading to a post-racial society just as recently as 2008. Correct?
Yeah, I remember that.
How'd that work out?
I remember that. We're in the most racial society we've had, in Lord knows when.
Yes. Again, the name of the book is The Last Thing You Surrender. Leonard Pitts Jr. is here with us. He is going to be at Park Road Books, if I could say it, tonight at 7 o'clock. He'll be signing and reading from the book. He's also a nationally syndicated newspaper columnist with the Miami Herald, and he follows current events very closely. And boy, do we have a lot of current events to talk about. So when we come back, we're going to talk more about the book, but we're also going to get into the state of Virginia and other matters. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest is Leonard Pitts Jr. He's in town for a book signing tonight at Park Road Books, and he is the author of the new novel, The Last Thing You Surrender. Tell me a little bit, we were talking about giving the reader hope. What was it like for you to write this book? You've got, obviously, endless racial prejudice. You've got POW camp torture. You've got domestic abuse. You've got rape. I mean, there are a lot of really heavy subjects, for lack of a better description, in this book. How much did that stay with you day to day as you were writing this?
Actually, surprisingly little. I think as a writer, when you're in the scene, you're in. Like, I guess it's like being an actor. When you're in the scene, you're in the scene. You're there. You're living it, and you're trying to transmit it as fully as you can. But then once it's done, you're on to the next page and the next writing problem, the next writing challenge. So while I was writing those scenes, there was a great impact. But I think as soon as you move on and you've got that scene nailed down, then you're on to the next thing. And it's at least for me, I haven't felt any residue.
Now, how long ago did you finish the book? How long have you had to kind of think about it?
I started doing the research in 2015, finished probably, I think the first draft probably 2 years ago.
Okay, so now you're obviously out, you're talking about it, you're seeing readers. What do you think of the finished project now that you've lived with this so long?
I think I like it. That's actually a very good question, because sometimes you don't know how you feel about a piece of work until you've lived with it. I've been, you know, reading and rereading various passages and listening to people who've read it talk about it, and I think I like it. I will tell you, to get back to your previous question, I didn't realize how much, you know, violence and whatever there was in the book until after it was completely done, and then you say, oh my God, this is, somebody called it a brutal read. They loved it, but they said it's a very brutal read, and I didn't have any sense of that as I was writing it. My sense was I need to keep faith with these people, and these these soldiers and all the things that they endured. I need to keep faith and make sure I transmit that properly. So I didn't really have any sense of that until afterward. And you say, oh my God, this is a tough book.
It was really interesting because I found myself reading the book quickly. I enjoyed, you know, the characters were compelling. But at some point when George Simon is in the Japanese POW camp, and you describe this with great detail, excruciating, not excruciating in terms of not fun to read, but it's very graphic. And all of a sudden that's when it hit me. Wow, these people have been through a lot of agony in these 400 pages or whatever.
We have a tendency in this country to want to, you know, rush past the hard parts and smush down the history that people have gone through. We want to get to the kumbaya moment, you know, when perhaps we haven't earned it by going through the hell that preceded, you know, vicariously going through the hell that preceded the kumbaya moment. So I, you know, anytime I write about the horrors of history, whether it's the Holocaust or whatever, I really want to put you there so that you can understand the people who have endured this, and I don't think we often want to do that. People seem to have this instinctive belief that you owe them happiness. You know,
we're always ready to go to Disney World.
Yeah, we're always ready to go to Disney World, and the world has not been Disney World for a lot of people. You know, for a lot of the time. And if you're really going to deal with that, then you owe it to them to deal with it. Forgetting what somebody's gone through or misrepresenting what somebody's gone through, to me, is like a second death. Mm-hmm. You know, so if we're talking about what somebody went through, some trial that somebody went through, I want to try to represent it in such a way that you can appreciate what they went through and why the fact that they are still here and functioning and hopeful in a lot of cases is such a miracle.
Which it is.
Yeah,
which it is. I think you convey that message well. I was going to ask you, you've obviously written a number of historical novels. You've written about the Civil War period. You've written about the Civil Rights era in the late 60s and other periods of American history. When you look at what's going on right now in this country, it is such an intense period. People are going to be, I think, pouring through this for a long time to come. Any interest in a contemporary novel?
I've actually thought about that. Nothing has really sprung up in whatever the place is that characters and plots come from, but it has occurred to me that I need to write about this era because there is such insanity going on in our political lives that it seems like it would be ripe fodder for a book, but. Nothing has sprung up immediately, so I don't know. Maybe history is more natural to me. History, mm-hmm. we've got a little bit of a remove, and you can really kind of absorb and analyze and discuss, as opposed to, oh my God, this is happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you. I mentioned the POW portion of the book, and this young Marine, George Simon, who is a very religious man when the war begins, and his faith is tested in numerous ways. But one of the interesting wrinkles that you include is when he's in this camp, his fellow prisoners are very covetous of a small Bible that George has. I never knew this aspect of the war. I'm assuming you discovered this somewhere along the way in history. Tell us about that particular circumstance.
Yeah, there's a writer named, I may mispronounce his name, Gawin, I believe it is, or Gavin Dawes, has a book called Prisoners of the Japanese, and that book was my main reference for all of the Japanese POW camp scenes. Tobacco was gold in the camps. The Red Cross would send cigarettes, factory made cigarettes, and the Japanese would steal them from the prisoners. But any man who could get his hands on some tobacco and some paper for rolling it, that man was in heaven. That man had a momentary escape from the camp. And according to what I read, the men, you know, you'd use any kind of paper you could get to roll a cigarette. You'd use toilet paper, although the toilet paper that the Japanese gave was more wood than paper. You'd use book paper. You know, Herman Melville was smoked up. Mark Twain was smoked up. But the absolute best
it's
paper.
It's like a literature class.
Yeah, exactly. But the best paper was apparently Bible paper because it's thinner. And it apparently, you know, was more like a regular factory cigarette. So they come to George, and he thinks that they want to borrow his Bible because they want some spiritual edification, you know. But they want to buy his Bible, and they're willing to give him, I think it's 2 factory cigarettes per chapter. They want to buy his Bible so that they can, you know, use it and resell it because it's worth that much to them.
And what's interesting is when he's faced with that offer, it's not so much that he's worried about breaking sacred faith by selling this. He just feels like that's the last piece of his dignity. That's the last thing he would surrender, obviously owing to the title, and so he just will not do it.
Yeah, he's just trying to hold on to some little aspect of who he used to be. And you're right. By this time, his faith has been shredded down to little or nothing. But yet and still, reading the Bible is something that he did in his former life. It was part of who he was. It identified him, and to have to give that up and to give it up for cigarettes. And George doesn't even smoke, by the way. And to have to give that up for cigarettes just feels like one indignity too many for him.
The one other aspect I want to ask you about the book before I ask you a little bit about current events is the relationship that George develops with Thelma Gordy, who is the widow, African-American woman and widow of the man who saved George. They begin a correspondence, and both of them are uneasy and can't really even understand how they're becoming friends in a way.
Right.
Just tell me a little bit about where that came from and how you explored that.
Well, I didn't... You know, books sort of evolve, characters sort of evolve, so they, in a way, they dictate what's going to happen. I knew that there was going to be some sort of relationship between them. I didn't know, you know, almost until the very end of the book, exactly what that relationship was going to be. But I liked the idea of these two. You know, in the world that existed at that time, there's no place where they could have sat across a table from one another and just had a chat. There's no restaurant, you know, where you can go as a black man, as a white man and a black woman in 1942, 43 or wherever and say, okay, we're going to sit down and have a date. That's not going to happen in Mobile, Alabama. So I liked the idea of them sort of getting to know one another, stripped of all the physical stuff. When you're writing a letter, it's just here are my thoughts, what are your thoughts? And I like the idea of them just sort of getting to know each other on that basis, having a relationship on that basis without all of the other stuff being so omnipresent for them.
That's the voice of Leonard Pitts Jr. He is here today. He will be at Park Road Books this evening, and he is promoting his new novel, The Last Thing You Surrender. So let's talk a little bit about your day job.
Okay.
You're still a nationally syndicated columnist, obviously, at the Miami Herald.
Yes, sir.
You've long lived in Washington, and the intersection of race and politics is your bailiwick.
Yes, sir.
So let's talk about Virginia. What in the world are we to make of this?
I was just on Twitter before I came in here, and I suggested that Virginia needs to be rebooted because Virginia is gone. It's just insane, and it's really kind of troubling. Ralph Northam, maybe he's a good man, maybe he's not. I don't know where he stands racially now. What strikes me is this whole idea, this whole fact that what he did, you know, this whole the blackface thing when he was 25 years old was apparently so ubiquitous at that time that he can't recall if he's right. The guy in the picture right. or not. But I did do it once.
Right. Not that time.
Not
but
that time, but the yeah. other time. And it's just, you know, I wrote a column about that. I don't know if it's appeared in Charlotte yet, but I wrote a column because, you know, my whole thing is that we as a nation are in full flight from our history, all of our history. We just don't teach or pass on our history, and specifically our African-American history, in particular our African-American history.
We say this in February.
Yeah, and in Black History Month. And it just occurs to me that if somebody had educated Ralph North, assuming he's a good guy, assuming Megyn Kelly's a good person, if somebody educated these people about African-American history, he might not have his career in flames. She might still be a talk show host. The Secretary of State of Florida, who also just got in trouble for this, might still be the Secretary of State of Florida, and on and on and on. It's just amazing to me the things that you have the privilege to not know and the ability to not know, essentially because you've been protected from that knowledge by a country, by a system that is pretty much declared certain things too difficult to know. There was a lady who wrote me once when I wrote a column about Black history. She told me that talking about this was not quote unquote polite, and that word that word has stuck with me because again it becomes a second death. These people were killed, you know, African American people were killed or enslaved or whatever, and now what you're telling me is that even the memory of what they endured, you know, is too upsetting for you to talk about. That's incredibly frustrating. I don't think anybody would go to a Jewish person who lost people in the Holocaust or to a Holocaust survivor and say, let's not talk about that. That's not polite. But it's something that is said and felt in this country pretty broadly. And I'll just close by adding, you know, you mentioned that the Ralph Northam story broke in the broke on the first day of Black History Month. It also broke in the 400th year of American slavery. It's been, in August, it's 400 years since the first African slaves arrived in Virginia. So it's like, you know, wow, really bad timing, Ralph.
Yes, yes. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, without letting anyone off the hook, whether it's Megyn Kelly or Ralph Northam yeah. or the Attorney General who right. condemned Ralph Northam and then said, oh, yeah, I did it too.
Yeah.
There's so many examples. It seems to me that at this particular point in our history, we're very good at having a mass condemnation, relatively
right.
speaking, of people. But then we just go right back to ignoring the history or not teaching the history or not being aware of it. So aren't we all, in a way, a little bit complicit in this?
Yeah, that's exactly my point. As I said, I don't know how good a person or bad a person, you know, any of these individuals are as regards race. I do know that they are all products of a nation that has almost officially outlawed or you know, denigrated the teaching of this history. So this ignorance is to be expected. This lack of sensitivity is to be expected when we have protected you from knowing these things, because knowing these things, it might upset you. Again, like I mentioned, that I don't owe you. I don't feel like we owe you happy ending. We don't. History doesn't owe you to make you feel good. History mm-hmm. History has no obligation to make you feel good. History has an obligation to teach you what came before, so that perhaps you can chart a different path for the future. But if you rob people of that history, that knowledge, then who knows what path they will chart in the future. They can chart putting on a Klan robe and blackface and call it a joke. You know, I get exactly what you're saying, and it's not to let Northam off the hook, because I think we have to take responsibility for what we do. But it is to say that it didn't come out of nowhere. You know, this is a guy, his ignorance was created. And it was intentionally created to, quote-unquote, protect him, although it seems not to have done that, obviously.
Again, I'm speaking with Leonard Pitts, Jr., and You know, I'm going to bring it a little closer, even closer to home, not that Virginia is very far away, but in North Carolina, mm-hmm. we've seen controversies over the removal of a Confederate statue at UNC Chapel Hill that's still not really resolved. We've heard federal judges reject voter ID laws for targeting black voters with, quote, surgical precision. Mm-hmm. We had riots over a fatal police shooting of an African-American resident. Again, these are not really unique things in America right now. But what I wanted to ask you is, what happened to the New South?
Yeah, I think Charlotte and Atlanta were the capitals of the New South. Again, I'll put it to you like this. When Barack Obama was elected president and we reached post-racial America, supposedly, I had the opportunity to interview one of my favorite historians, Lerone Bennett Jr., the author of Before the Mayflower. And he was not impressed with post-racial America. He told me, I'm an old cat. This is not the first time racism has ended in this country. And then, you know, he went on to list, you know, a few of the period, beginning with the end of slavery, when, quote-unquote, racism ended in this country. It gets back to the thing of we want this to be easy. We want it to happen in a lightning bolt. Obama's elected. Hey, racism's over. The Civil Rights Act has been enacted. Racism's over.
Right. Clear the scoreboard.
It's done. And I think the thing that we have to at some point get through our heads is this is an ongoing struggle. This is, you know, to become that more perfect union, to become better people. This is an ongoing thing. There's no finish line. There's getting better. And until and unless we're willing to put in the work at that, until and unless we stop looking for this magic point at which we can say, okay, we're done. Here's the promised land. Until or else we're destined, we're doomed to continue being disappointed, in our inability to reach our own highest ideals.
And I'm going to ask you a quick yes or no question as we roll towards the break, but do you think that we're going to need to go through each of these yearbooks and all those things? Do we need to go through those each time?
Yeah, I guess the short answer would be yes.
There you go. That's a pro. Again, that's the voice of Leonard Pitts Jr. He is the author of the new novel, The Last Thing You Surrender. He's in Charlotte tonight at Park Road Books. He'll be signing books and reading from the new book. Stay with us. We're going to talk a little bit more about current events and dig back into that novel here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. And my guest is Leonard Pitts Jr., who is the author of The Last Thing You Surrender. I put you against the wall there with that last question. So let me reintroduce the topic, which is we were talking about, you know, if we're going to need to, as a country, relitigate all these things that are popping up. And I mentioned to you during the break, there were some tweets yesterday with pictures from the UNC Chapel Hill yearbook of fraternities with having parties with people in blackface and Klan robes. And right. I'm sure we're nowhere near the end of what's out there. So how do we approach this?
I think that there's a crying need in this country to mandate the teaching of, first of all, American history, and then specifically, you know, the history of this country as regards the dispossessed and the despised, meaning the African American experience, the Latino American experience, the Native American experience. Lord, when is that discussed?
Yeah.
You know, so all of the, we need to discuss these things. I think it'll make us a lot less ignorant. I'm stubbornly of the belief that Anne Frank was right when she said she believed that I think most people are good at heart. I think most people, you know, want to be thought of as good people, but the fact is that we've sabotaged that. You know, again, assuming Northam, I think Northam is probably a decent guy. He goes to an African American church. I mean, that's not the profile of a Klansman. But he was dumb enough at age 25, which is a pretty advanced age. He was dumb enough at age 25 to do this kind of thing. So what does that say about how this supposedly, you know, good guy was educated by the people that should have taught him better?
Well, whenever we dig into this subject, I think of Bryan Stevenson talking about how in Europe and South Africa you have markers and museums, right, and constant reminders in your day-to-day life of what happened. And what I mean by what happened is the awful things that happened, right. Whether it's apartheid or the Holocaust, so on and so forth. And in America, we really don't. In fact, we're still having the fight about the Confederate monuments, but not monuments to victims of slavery and lynching and so on and so forth. So what's your prognosis on Americans having a willingness at some point to confront this head on?
I don't know. I don't think I'll live to see it. I'll put it like that. And it's not even to say that what they do in Europe and in South Africa has been perfect. And I don't think it has. But I think it does reflect a more mature assessment of what needs to be done. In this country, we've gotten nowhere near that mature assessment. It strikes me, you know, the perfect symbol of this is the sign on the Tallahatchie River in Mississippi, where they fished Emmett Till's body out of the river. And they have a marker there that's been shot up repeatedly. It is almost literally an attempt to murder memory. Somebody told me the other day, I'm not sure how true this is, but somebody told me that they're getting ready to erect a new marker that will be bulletproof.
Wow.
And there's a need to erect a bulletproof marker at that site. That tells you how resistant too many of us are to dealing with this, you know, the atrocities in our history. I would think that, and we are, 60-some years later, we would all be able to say that the murder, the mutilation and murder and torture of a 14-year-old boy, you know, an innocent boy, was something that we can all get by, all condemn.
Right.
All say this was a terrible thing. You know, we all, as a nation, we should all be able to say that. And we really have, we really are not that nation yet. There's a quote from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, which talks about this sense of guilt that we have with our history. He says, "Few are guilty, but all are responsible." And that strikes me as that there's just such wisdom in there, and we as Americans have yet to be willing to shoulder that responsibility for the atrocities of our country.
The switching gears abruptly, or maybe not so abruptly, in terms of politics, in 2020, the Republican National Convention will be right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. When that convention ends, your best guess, is Donald Trump the nominee?
Yeah, I think Donald Trump is the nominee. I the Republican Party has disappointed me mightily by showing the spinal fortitude of Gumby with regard to standing up to Donald Trump and all that he represents. So I have no expectation that the party is going to suddenly choose to save itself and elect some more sensible choice.
You know, when there was a period not so long ago, pre-Trump, when the Republicans came out of the 2012 election, when Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama, saying that they were going to have to do things differently, they were going to have to be much more diverse. I'm sure you've heard throughout your life the idea of Democrats taking black voters for granted.
Yeah, I've said that.
Why do you think the Republican Party has not been more aggressive, even pre-Trump, going after the black voters?
I think there's a certain amount of inertia. I think that they have found it, they've gotten into the habit, they got into the habit long before Trump, of using black voters as sort of, or black people, I should say, as sort of their personal boogeymen. You know, vote for us or this is going to happen. They use LGBTQ people in much the same way and Muslims in much the same way, but black folks were the original. black folks were the original boogeymen of the Republican Party. And rather than do outreach to the, you know, I spent the 90s writing columns begging the Republican Party for some sort of outreach, because the Democratic Party has been allowed and should never have been allowed to take the black vote for granted. You know, Democrats treat the black vote, have treated, I think it's changing now, but have long treated the black vote like, you know, that girlfriend or boyfriend that, you know, yeah, I like being with you, but you're not the most attractive, so I don't want to acknowledge you in public. It's that sort of thing. And the Republican Party has had this golden opportunity. African American voters are more, you know, the Republican Party is the party of religion and conservatism. African American voters are more religious on whole than the country at large. African American voters, there's a large percentage who are very conservative on most of the litmus test issues of conservatism.
Socially conservative.
Yeah, socially conservative. Yet those people vote Democrat. Why is that, Republic? It seems to me there was somebody in the Republican Party would have thought of this a long time ago. They never do because they are so wedded to this idea of racial and cultural boogeymen. That's how they get. That's how they win votes. They win votes by playing on fear. If you don't vote for us, Jesse Jackson is going to make your daughter get gay married on the front lawn of the White House while a lesbian burns a flag. You know, that's essentially. That's essentially, you know, the appeal, and demographically. It has to run out sometime, and I don't know where the party will be when it does.
You wrote in one of your columns in 2017, quote, "Donald John Trump is a man whose cognitive and moral deficits would, in a sane country, render him unfit to clean toilets at a reasonably respectable strip club." I think you got your point across. But that said, I think many people would say you, for those who are opposed to Trump, you underestimate him at your peril. What do you think the likelihood is? And I know the world moves so fast, God knows what will happen between now and then. But just based on what we know right now, how likely would he be to be reelected?
I don't think he's going to be reelected, and I do know that I say this having not thought he was going to be elected the first time, and I feel like there's a danger of being like those Republicans in Obama's second election who were just so convinced, of their narrative, he's so awful, there's no way this guy's going to be reelected. On election night, you have Karl Rove going back to check the numbers on Fox News because he can't believe it, and some poor guy committed suicide down in Key West. Yeah, because he couldn't believe it. So I really don't want to be those people in hindsight. But I, you know, at this point, I think the tide of anger and the sense that there's an urgency here to save the country. I don't see him being able to surmount that. But again, you know, who knows?
Yeah,
this is America in 2019. Who knows?
Again, my guest is Leonard Pitts, Jr. He is a nationally syndicated columnist, and he is also a novelist. And his new book is called The Last Thing You Surrender, and it's set during World War II. I want to go back to the book for a minute, and this is just purely for personal fun here. I'm a huge baseball fan. Uh-huh. January 31st, Jackie Robinson would have turned 100 years old. And you have a nice cameo moment with the 761st Tank Battalion, which was a real-life battalion. Jackie Robinson was actually part of that battalion.
Yes.
But he has a nice walk-on moment, and I'm wondering whether that's one of the joys of dabbling in historical fiction, because you can intermingle these characters with some real-life heroes.
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, George S. Patton has a moment in the book, Jackie Robinson. That's some of the fun when you get a chance to put your fiction up against the actual fact. And the first draft of the book, as a matter of fact, and I had to cut this for space, there was a chapter with Jackie Robinson.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with Jackie Robinson interacting with my character Luther. Because Jackie Robinson is renowned for for having to show patience and forbearance during that first season when he was, you know, being tormented by all these folks. But he was not naturally a very patient or forbearing person. And so, you know, my chapter sort of dealt, and as you know from reading the book, neither is Luther.
Right.
So my chapter had the two of them sort of, you know.
I could see how they would get along.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of commiserating on that point. And then, you know, Jackie Robinson faces this court martial on a bogus charge and actually never gets to go overseas with the Black Panther battalion. And I have Luther wondering, I wonder what's going to happen to that guy. I wonder if I'll ever see or hear from him again.
Yeah, what's going to happen with him? It was funny when I was driving over here today thinking about the interview and thinking about that moment in the book in particular. It strikes me that with Jackie Robinson, his story to me becomes even more improbable as time goes on. When you really look at what he did in the military, obviously what he did in college, and then, you know, the ultimate accomplishment with breaking the color line. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of accomplishment in a short life.
Yeah, he died in, 72, I think it was, and wasn't very old. Died in his 50s, if I recall correctly. Yeah, it was a heck of a lot of accomplishment. As I look back on, you know, obviously the major accomplishment was keeping his mouth shut and not rising to the bait during that first season. isn't that a heck of a thing to demand of somebody?
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, while you're trying to hit a 95 mile an hour fastball.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So you look back at that and he celebrated for it, and rightly so. But I think that the country should be ashamed that it ever required that of him, that this was something that he had to bear, to go through, so that we could have, Major League Baseball, I guess it is, and a country as we know them.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you're going from all of these historical projects, writing the novels, and then you're very much living in the present with everything going on politically. How do you balance those two?
You mean the writing the column and
yeah?
Well, yeah, you know, history is alive even in my columns. I think that you can't really understand what's going on in the country now, and not just during this era, but any era, if you don't have some understanding of the history that preceded it. I think, again, that's one of our problems as a people. We're constantly coming in the middle of the movie and trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. Nobody ever wants to go back and look at the beginning and say, okay, so this led to this and this led to the other thing. So to me, it's not so much of a balancing. I think they complement each other. I think that I write columns because that's what I get paid to do. That's what puts what puts dinner on the table and gas in the tank. I write novels because that's what sort of feeds my soul. That's what makes me feel whole and 100%. You know, the column is dinner and the novels are dessert, both of which you need for a balanced life.
That's exactly right. As we're going through so many of these challenges and problems that the country has faced and is still facing, I'm wondering whether you remain optimistic. When you read the work of someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates or you hear him speak, he most definitely is not optimistic about what's ahead. What's your view when you take the racial and the political and you put it all together in America right now? How are you feeling about things?
Optimism is difficult, but as I've always said, when people ask me that question, if you're not optimistic, then why get up in the morning? If you're not optimistic, there's no point in getting up in the morning. So I find optimism is more difficult now than it was for me before the 2016 election. And I find myself struggling with a deep disappointment with 63 million of my fellow Americans, because it just bothers me and frustrates me to no end that they could look at this guy and know that he's a racist, he's a misogynist, he's an Islamophobe, and none of those things was a deal breaker. The fact that none of those things was a deal breaker really troubles me. So I feel estranged from 63 million of my fellow Americans. But at the same time, as I keep pointing to, reminding people, 66 million people said something else. So that to me is where the hope lies. That to me is where any optimism that I can have arises from that. That I still think that there are more of, and I hate to use these terms, but there's more of us than there are of them.
When you get to this point in the life cycle of a book, are you already thinking about your next topic, or what point do you start to ponder?
Yeah, I'm pondering a couple of ideas. I'm pondering a possible sequel to this book, because as you will know from having read it, one of the major villains kind of gets away, and I didn't like the fact that I couldn't think of a realistic way to get him what he deserves. So, I may come back just for that, just to make sure that, this individual gets what he has coming to him. There's always something percolating. There's always another book percolating.
Always something percolating. Leonard Pitts Jr., it's been a joy to have you here.
Pleasure.
The book is called The Last Thing You Surrender. He will be at Park Road Books tonight at 7 o'clock. Go to our website, wfae.org, for more details. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.